Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It is impossible to overstate the stakes of the U.S. airstrike in Baghdad Thursday night, which will almost certainly be taken as an act of war by Iran.
There's plenty of places where the Iranians could hit the United States. They could do it practically anywhere in the world, actually. They could start sinking oil tankers. The two things the Iranians are really good at are truck bombs and hostage taking. But, you know, this could get out of control pretty fast.
Dexter Filkins reports extensively on the Middle East, and he's profiled the Iranian military leader who was killed in the airstrike. I'll talk with Dexter on the podcast of the New Yorker Radio Hour, or you can find it at newyorkerradio.org. Now, I've got a confession to make. When I first started doing this program, I was a little anxious. I've been a print journalist all my life, a writer and an editor, but talking to you in my own voice, on the radio or a podcast, felt a little strange. So to prepare myself, I decided to study the great ones, and at the very top of that list has got to be Terry Gross. Gross has been the host of Fresh Air for nearly 45 years. And over that time, she's interviewed thousands and thousands of guests, from Ray Charles to Hillary Clinton to, I don't know, any summary of her big guests doesn't actually do her justice. Terry is perhaps the best interviewer of our time. Let's strike the perhaps. She is. Terry Gross joined me in October 2019 at the New Yorker Festival, where the crowd welcomed her like a rock star. Terry, I'm basically going to steal tips from you. I don't really care about them. I want to know how you do it, because you when you go into an interview, it's obvious to me, and I think all your listeners from the get-go, that you are so grounded in what the knowledge that's necessary to have for an extended real conversation. I'd like to know about process. What goes into your week? How does it work?
Well, I do the research the afternoon and the night before. And then in the morning, I write up the questions. My interview is often at 10 in the morning, so I don't have a lot of time to do anything, really. And then after that, I'm reading the copy to introduce guests. While the show is actually on the air, so to speak, I'm in the studio just in case, but I've tried to pre-record all the introductions, and I'm writing copy for tomorrow's show while our show is on, and then back to the rest.
You don't do it all yourself. God knows, I even on our modest show, I have a team of people that works very hard to do research and book people and all the rest. You've had some of the same people for a very long time.
Yeah, right? We have a great generational mix on our show. People are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. We try so hard to keep up with pop culture. It's not possible anymore. There is just too much to keep up with. So they go to the film festivals and watch all the Netflix stuff that's coming out and all the screenings and TV shows. And then they'll give me like little film festival things. You know, like they'll show me scenes from earlier movies. I'll see the new movie, and maybe I've seen some of their old movies already, but then they'll show me scenes from movies. Or if it's one of those like 20 episodes they drop at the same time kind of things, the producers will watch the episodes, give me a good sense of like the highlights, show me scenes. But when it comes to the book, like, with few exceptions, I will be the one who reads the book and reads the research and you know, do all the processing of that.
One of the distinguishing features of your show and being on it is that we're never in the same, very rarely in the same room with you. I've been interviewed by you, as a lot of people at The New Yorker have, and what they do is they go to a public radio studio and they put on headphones, and sooner or later, after the usual what did you have for breakfast to get sound levels, you come on and you welcome us, and you give us a few rules. What are they?
Okay, the advice I always give, it's kind of like the Bill of Rights that I read to people. And I tell them that since we're recording, they should feel free to take advantage of that. If at any point in the middle of an answer, if they feel like they figured out what they really wanted to say, or they just thought of a clearer, better, more concise way of putting it, and they want a second crack at it, they can back up to an earlier part of the answer and say it again. But if they do that, they should start at the beginning of a sentence so we can make a clean edit. And if I ask them anything too personal, they should let me know, and I'll move on to something else. And I'll also tell them, like, if I make a mistake, interrupt me and correct me. That way I can say it again and get it right. We can edit out the error and prevent it from going on the air and prevent it from being on your Wikipedia page forever.
Now, I think you probably know what's coming next. I was raised in print journalism, and if I were interviewing Henry Kissinger, and it slipped out of his mouth, tomorrow I'm going to bomb Cambodia, and then he said, wait a minute, I didn't mean that, I wouldn't, and we were on the record, I wouldn't give him a backseas. I wouldn't let him redo it. I understand it completely for lots of other fields and of endeavor, but particularly in political conversation, consequential.
Yes. And
areas.
I neglected to say I do not do that with politicians.
So who would you not do it with?
Anybody who's in elected office or running for elected office.
But you told me.
But
you,
I don't interview them anyway. So
yeah,
it's
you don't
kind
like doing
point.
Politicians, do you?
No, because for two reasons. One is I feel like they walk in with their talking points, and
right.
No matter what you ask them, that's what they're going to tell you. And the other thing is, I think if you're interviewing a politician, you owe it to your readers or to your listeners to know the difference between the bullshit and the truth. And if you're not following them on a regular basis, you're not gonna necessarily be able to catch that. If I'm doing, say, like 3 hours of research, or even if I'm taking off a day just to prepare for
right.
that interview, I'm not gonna know enough to know when they're just being hypocritical or denying an action, covering up an action. If you're following them, if you're covering them on your beat, you will know the difference and be able to catch them in that. So I feel like unprepared and therefore inept at doing that. I just don't, I take politics too seriously to be in the position where I'm letting somebody get away with something.
How soon into an interview do you know this is going to be good or this is going to be not so good?
Sometimes I feel like I know on the sound check. Sometimes somebody is so kind of grumpy and just like, oh, they made me be here. It says in my contract I have to be here to promote and I'm here. What do you want from me? You know, and you can just tell. Sometimes you get past the first few questions and suddenly you hear a shift. And you hear like somebody's kind of clicking in and engaging, and that's it's great when that happens.
And there's an advantage to being in Philadelphia by yourself. It seems paradoxical to me because you would think, as in the conversation we're having now, despite the fact that there are all these other people, we have physical cues. We have ways that our eyes work or our hands or something to
yeah.
indicate confusion or ask me more or back off or something. You don't have that, but maybe you're listening better. I don't know.
Well, I was thinking the best of all possible worlds, since we're both just hearing each other, that we're making better radio because everything has to, all the cues have to be in our voices.
Right.
And whether that's actually true or not, in terms of being effective, I don't know. But there is something incredibly, surprisingly intimate about having somebody's voice just fed into your ears, directly kind of into your head and your brain.
Terry, you grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up in New Jersey, same radio area. If we're being honest with ourselves, when we were kids, and you're just a little older than me, there were no women on the radio. There was
Allison Steele, the Nightbird.
The Nightbird, WNEW-FM.
Yes.
Kind of purring into the...
Exactly.
Into the microphone.
The night will soothe you like a tender mother, folding you against her soft bosom and hiding you from the harm of the world. In this brief hour, you are master of all highways, and the universe nestles in your soul. So come, fly with me. Allison Steele. The Nightbird, at WNEW-FM in stereo.
And that was it. What were you listening to and what excited you?
Well, when I was very young, I was listening to AM radio. Murray the K was my favorite. I used to love how he'd play the instrumental part, talk over it, and knew exactly how many seconds it was going to take. And as soon as he stopped talking, the vocal would start, and it would be just like perfect timing.
Hey, baby, it's Murray the K with the Beatles, and we're talking to you from London, England, where it's all happening over here. What you're about to hear happened in Miami. Ringo and I sitting on the beach.
Now, there was a period of your life where you were kind of, as I understand it, a little on the directionless side. I think the Amish would call it a Rumspringer. When you're in your early 20s and you go to sort of shed your identity from Sheepshead Bay a little bit, you were in a hippie commune, am I right?
Well, to be precise, when I was in college, we called it a collective, not a commune, in the sense that, like, at least for a long period, we'd share our money and the cooking and the cleaning and all that, which I think is a very sensible, you know, arrangement to have. And then we did something really silly. We spent the summer on a professor's land, living in tents. And when it would really storm, we'd go to the Dunkin' Donuts. And that would be my favorite part. I was so not cut out for, like, living in tents and,
yeah.
You know.
You wouldn't have done well at Woodstock, I don't think.
Oh, I went to Woodstock.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What did you think you were going to do with your life? You're in Buffalo, and you were studying to teach. You were a teacher for a little while.
I was a teacher. I got fired within 6 weeks because I was that good.
That's a bad teacher. How'd you get fired in 6 weeks?
Well, it was kind of easy. it was 8th grade English, junior high, in Buffalo, New York's toughest inner city junior high. When someone from the Board of Ed came to observe me, my students overturned the bookcase as if to send a direct message, like, she doesn't know what she's doing, and I didn't. I didn't know how to keep them in the classroom, let alone to teach.
It seems harsh, though, to get
fired
in 6 weeks.
I was really short then, like I'm short now. And you know, I wasn't much older than they were, and I really didn't know how to be an authority figure. They needed structure. They needed security. Those were the things that they often didn't have at home or in the streets, and I didn't know how to give it to them.
So you go back home in defeat. Maybe doing some typing, I think, to
I worked at temp agencies,
yeah,
where I got criticized for, when there was no work to do, reading.
Yeah. So you decided to make
a
virtual
business. It was a terrible thing. Terrible, terrible thing.
But so radio came to you, it seems to me, in a pretty odd way. If there was a feminist radio station or a feminist radio show in Buffalo.
There was a feminist radio show at the college station, and which I had been listening to at another job I had, which was typing the Buffalo State College faculty policy manual. So, you know, work doesn't get more interesting than that. So, I had on WBFO, the station on the college campus, in the background, and like, oh, God, the shows were so good. And when my job at the faculty policy manual was over, because I had typed everything.
Efficient.
I ended up having a roommate back in the house that was not a commune, who was going to be on the feminist show. And it turns out that she came out on the show, and then her girlfriend was moving to the lesbian feminist show, opening up a place on the feminist show.
Perfect.
Which is the, right, which is a long story, but I ended up taking that place.
Terry Gross at the New Yorker Festival. When we continue, we'll hear about how being on the radio helped her overcome her shyness. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Thank you. there's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The holidays are over, so it's back to work or whatever else you've got going on. And to cheer you up a little bit, we're going to feature today none other than Terry Gross. Terry and I spoke at the New Yorker Festival about her very first time hosting a radio show. What was that first show like? What was your voice like?
My voice was kind of like that. Like, it was really high. Because, one, because I was younger. Two, because when I get nervous, my voice tends to get high. And that was especially true before I understood how my voice worked.
So how did you do that? In other words, how did you listen to yourself, train yourself, and make it the voice that we hear every day and love?
Well, when I first heard my voice, it was really a horrible experience. I don't know if that's true for people now because people have cell phones and you can record your voice on it. But I hadn't heard my voice. And so, you know, the way our voices sound between our ears is very different than they sound on tape. So when I heard it on tape, it was like, oh my God, do I sound that way? And I tried to speak more slowly. I tried to not sound kind of like this. But it's hard. You know, it's hard. But one of the smartest things I did, I think, I took Alexander lessons, which is a posture. You know about it?
I don't.
Oh, it's called Alexander Technique, and it's posture lessons. Don't judge my posture. because I'm still not very, very well postured, but it's British actors take Alexander Technique lessons, and a lot of musicians do too, because you get tendonitis, like if you hold your wrist wrong and you're mm-hmm. playing guitar or piano or any instrument. So they teach you like how to hold things in alignment, so A, that you don't hurt, and B, just so everything is aligned. And part of that, if you're talking like this or talking like that, it's going to affect your vocal cords.
Okay, so teach me. I need to sit up straight.
Well, and to breathe from the diaphragm.
Oh, like a singer.
Like a singer.
Right. I was talking to a friend at WNYC, and she said, you know, the thing you have to understand about a career like Terry Gross is that it was made possible by the fact that public radio paid so poorly that women came to public radio. So Cokie Roberts, Susan Stamberg, and the rest of that, the whole All Things Considered crew, which was quite female compared to the rest of radio. True?
Okay, there's probably some truth to that, because men could get higher salaries, and right. public radio was brand new.
But in the early 70s, right? Something like that?
In the early 70s. But there's other reasons for it. One of the reasons is named Bill Siemering. Because Bill Siemering, the first vice president for programming, or first head of programming, had feminist values. And he hired Susan Stamberg, and he hired other women. He wanted women on the air. And he was told, you're making a big mistake. But he knew he wasn't. And he set the tone.
There was the voice of authority from New York, male voice, reading the news. Not really hearing from people they were talking about. There weren't women on the air. I don't think there were hardly any people of color on air. So I believe that if you have the diversity of the country reflected on air, you'll have a diverse audience. If people hear their own voice, their own perspective being acknowledged, they will pay attention.
But another reason why is public radio, NPR, the talent, a lot of it came from the local stations. stations like WBFO in Buffalo, where I worked. And because feminism was so active on college campuses then, that was like ground zero for most of the feminist movement in a lot of ways. And so feminists like me were coming to their public radio station on the college campus and getting their start there. You know, there was so, like, it was the start of the new wave of the women's movement, and you were hearing that on the local public radio stations, and it helped feed NPR, because that's where a lot of the talent was coming from.
You once wrote this: I often ask my guests about what they consider to be their invisible weaknesses and shortcomings. I do this because these are the characteristics that define us no less than our strengths. What we feel sets us apart from other people is often the thing that shapes us as individuals. What do you see as your own invisible weaknesses, especially vis-a-vis your professional life?
Well,
because I don't see any.
I admit I'm perfect, but
yeah.
Since you asked, I'll try
end
to find a couple.
End of discussion.
Yeah. I think, you know, I've overcome this, but I was an inherently shy person. And, like, the microphone kind of liberated me to ask things and to have a power that I never felt that I had.
And it was hard at first?
I didn't know how to do it at first, but I enjoyed it immediately.
You got off on it in a certain way.
Well, it was like, you know, I like theater, but I'm not an actor. I like reading, but I never got to talk to authors. I love movies, and I never got to talk to the people who make them. And this was a way of doing things like that.
It's permission.
It's permission. And it's permission, you know, I grew up socialized to be liked. You know, I'm from the generation of women where, you know, be nice, be liked, don't create a problem. And, like, suddenly, like, no, it's not about being liked. It's about doing your job, holding people accountable, asking probing questions, asking sensitive questions.
Is there any relationship between conversation and therapy? Have you ever gone through therapy at all?
I see a therapist, and I love therapy, because, you know, but it's a really different relationship, and I'll try to define the difference. Like, when you're in therapy, the therapist's job is to help me, right? To help me understand myself and get through life in as painless a way as possible.
Ideally, yes.
And to help me think through matters that are very perplexing and that are making it hard for me to move forward. But the job of the interviewer, I'm not there to be your life coach or to help you solve your problems. I am there to help you clarify your thoughts, to help you express those thoughts, to help shape the narrative that I'm going to try to move you through, and to ask you questions that I think might be helpful in maybe even in framing some new thoughts. And, you know, perhaps in seeing something in a different way, but probably not.
But
the best possible scenario.
But you seem uniquely able to get people to unburden themselves or be honest about themselves. I look back to an interview that you did with the great artist Maurice Sendak, and his capacity to talk to you about issues of, and these are issues that are run throughout your interviews, about mortality and illness and dying, which are not easy to talk to about anybody, much less a stranger, over a dedicated line. It's astonishing.
My tears flow because two great, great friends died close together, a husband and a wife, who meant everything to me, and I'm having to deal with that. And it's very, very hard.
Did they die very recently?
Yes. She died 2 months ago, and he died the day before yesterday, and I was, except for his son, the last person to speak with him. He was my publisher, and I loved him, and I loved her.
Are you at the point where you feel like you've outlived a lot of people who you
yes.
loved?
Of course. And since I don't believe in another world, in another life, then this is it. And when they die, they're out of my life. They're gone forever. Blank. And I'm not afraid of death.
Do you have any theory of why you become this receptacle of that kind of...
Well, with Maurice, I mean, I'd been interviewing him over the years, so I wouldn't say we were friends, but we were interview buddies by that point.
Right.
Like, we'd been through it before, but I think I kind of learned as an interviewer and as an interviewee that the way to get somebody to speak honestly and openly isn't to flatter them or to show off. It's to ask questions that show your comprehension, if you can, of the work that they've done, and show through your questions that it has deeply affected you, that it matters to you.
Terry, thank you, and thank you all. Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air since 1975. We spoke at the New Yorker Festival in October 2019. Special thanks to Radio Diaries and Joe Richman, who interviewed the NPR pioneer Bill Siemering. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. 2020 will inevitably be a year of some very serious debate. I think the Senate is about to take up some major business related to the presidency. But before we get to that, let's get some important stuff out of the way first.
Ladies and gentlemen, all rise.
Sit.
I'm David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, and possibly in a career-ending move, your judge for the day.
Since humans hanging around their caves first domesticated wild animals, we've been arguing about which is better, dogs or cats. And a few years back, we decided to settle that question once and for all. And so live on stage at The New Yorker Festival, with a panel of highly distinguished experts on each side, we really went at it.
Now listen, I don't have a dog or a cat in this fight. I have to admit that domestic animals and me, we don't get along all that well. So I am the ideal person to have a certain kind of dispassionate judgment in this case. But you are the jury. You, the audience, will decide the verdict. So let's get started. Opening for the team dogs is defense counsel, Mr. Adam Gopnik.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, opposing counsel. I stand before this audience in whose hands the verdict will be decided tonight, not in any sense as an enemy of the cat or all the things that it represents. If I were inclined to do that, I might point out that without cats, my good friend, Andrew Lloyd Webber would have no career. We could compile a list of such offenses that we would hold cats liable for, but we are not going to do that. Not tonight. All we have on our side, ladies and gentlemen, is simple truth. The truth of the dog will be presented to you tonight in contradiction to what I can only call, with affection and esteem, the cult of the cat. And I use the word cult, my friends, very advisedly. For what is a cult? After all, Mr. Lane, a cult is simply an occasion when a group of otherwise intelligent people invest an object with emotions and intellectual powers that it possesses only through their projection of them into that creature. And in it, The cultists always insist that they can see signs of extraordinary powers to which all rational people are blind. On the other hand, we have the dog. We have the evolutionary miracle
order
of the dog.
Thank you.
We go back to the cave of Chauvet, 50,000 years ago, when Neolithic man was just beginning to scrawl on the sides of the cave. What do we find there? We find the track of only one animal, the track of a dog walking across the floor of the cave in perfect unison with a small child who must be his master. Think about that, that the dog was the first animal to willfully break the circle of the campfire, to enter into codependence with man. We will show you how dogs can tend, how dogs can shepherd, how dogs can hunt, how dogs can care. We will show you dogs helping blind people across the street. I would challenge you, my good friend, Mr. Lane, to show us a single cat who has ever helped the blind across the street. But we will show you, I think, more than that. We will show, for instance, that all dogs are Democrats and all cats are Republicans. And if you think about it, it's necessarily true. Dogs are social animals par excellence. They are exemplars of loyalty, engagement. It is the cat who removes himself from society, who pretends that others do not exist and need not be cared for. The cat is Republican in every imaginable way, and it is the sociable dog who is the true Democrat. So the choice before you tonight will not merely be the choice between the cult of the cat and the enduring truth of the dog, but also, and remember this when you vote, between your deepest political and ethnic allegiances, which we will ask you to express. I turn the lectern over to my good friend, the attorney for the cat.
Mr. Lane.
Your Serene Majesty of ultimate power and oneness. Dog people. it's wonderful that you've all felt that you could come here tonight to fulfill your civic duty as a jury. I live in a household which has cats and dogs, fine examples of each. And to be fair, living with them all has increased my affection for and appreciation of the dog. What a piece of work is a dog. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, how an action like an angel, how an appreciation like a dog. I come down in the morning. The two dogs greet me not with good day, master, or how nice to see you again after a break of 7.5 hours, but as if I were a gravely wounded and richly decorated soldier returning from the First World War. And meanwhile, the cat is sitting up there on the windowsill going, if we're going to understand cats this evening, and I have absolutely no doubt that we're not going to. The way to imagine a cat is at every point it is smoking an invisible, filterless, white French cigarette. Everything that we love and admire about a dog is bad education for the soul. The way that they reward everything you could possibly ever want. The way they tell us that every day is going to be great. Every day is going to be the best day you've ever had in your life. Every day you're going to jump for joy. That your friends are always there for you, like Rachel and Ross, you know, full of, brimming with interesting smells. If you are a serious, perceptive person, if you are someone who lives in the world and know what it consists of, if, in other words, you are a New Yorker reader, you know that that's wrong, okay? And essentially what a dog is asking you to do, in complete distinction to what Adam said, is to live a lie. Because there are sometimes those days when you just want to be alone, okay? Not because you're aloof and Republican, but maybe just if you feel like being alone. Then look to the cat. If cleanliness is next to godliness, and both rank just below tuna, welcome to my template. All I'm asking, really, is that you live in truth, because truth is cats. Cats is truth. That's all you know on earth and all you need to know. Apart from the fact that the inside of a vole is, if anything, even more interesting than the outside. The naming of cats is a difficult matter, but the voting for cats is very simple indeed. You know what to do.
The next speaker is from the dog side, Malcolm Gladwell, who's the author of 4 New York Times super-selling books, I would say, including What the Dog Saw and Other Adventures, which contains his profile of the dog whisperer, Cesar Millan. Mr. Gladwell.
Thank you. Judge, members of the jury, I think it is really up to me in debates like this to really see the big picture. To raise the questions I think, frankly, very few of us, very particularly members of the cat side of Team Cat, have either the imagination or, frankly, the courage to bring up, which is that this whole debate has massive national security implications. Allow me to explain with a story from my own experience. Not long ago, I was on an American Airlines flight from Miami to New York, and there was a bomb scare. And the pilot pulled the plane to the very edge of the airport, and the baggage handlers came and they unloaded every piece of luggage on the plane and put it in a long row up and down the tarmac, 200 yards long, and brought out an absolutely adorable German Shepherd with his handler. And the German Shepherd started at one end, tail wagging furiously, and sniffed each bag up and down in one long, furious gallop, all the while projecting an air of absolute purpose and happiness. And thus, clear of danger, we resumed our journey. Now, allow me to make the absolutely obvious, but nonetheless so often overlooked observation. No cat would do that. Now, why are cats so resolutely indifferent to pulling their weight in the war against terror? One answer might be the cat is ill-equipped to handle the task of bomb sniffing. That's nonsense. You know as well as I do that their noses are certainly up to the task. Another standard response might be, well, the cat is somehow indifferent to the threat that explosive materials pose to life. And we could put that to rest so easily merely by popping a balloon next to the ear of a sleeping cat. Observe his reaction. He is absolutely aware of the threat explosive materials pose to life. So what's the answer? Well, I think it's staring us in the face. The cat does not sniff for bombs because the cat doesn't want to sniff for bombs. Now, why? I think the answer lies in the famous distinction that has been brought to bear by the psychologist Carol Dweck, who in some of her seminal work over the last 10 years has argued that human beings can be divided into one of two groups, those with what she calls a fixed mindset and those with what she calls an effort mindset. The person with the fixed mindset, according to Dweck, has a notion that their abilities are innate. People with an effort mindset, on the other hand, think of their abilities as fluid, as things that can be enhanced by effort and practice. I think you can see where I'm going with this. Dogs have an effort mindset. Cats have a fixed mindset. The cat does not sniff for bombs because if he misses one, he greatly fears that he has put his entire essence, his very cattiness, at risk. The dog has no such anxiety. Right? He says to himself as he propels himself down the runway, filled with happiness and purpose, that it is better to have sniffed and missed than never to have sniffed at all. Think about that. Think about that when Team Cat goes on and on, as they surely will, about how cute cats are. And when they show you a cute picture, remind yourself how many lives have been needlessly put at risk because of the cat's excessive self-regard. We are engaged in a life or death struggle in the West, and the cat is sleeping on the sidelines.
Aria Levy is a staff writer for the magazine, and her article, Living Room Leopards, appeared almost against my will in both the magazine and the Big New Yorker book of cats. I kid, it was a marvelous piece. Ari Levy.
Malcolm, you want to talk about the truth? Paolo came into my life as a bit of very large baggage with my last relationship. A decade ago, Paolo and his owner moved into my one-bedroom apartment, and immediately, the cat and I recognized each other for what we were. Natural enemies. From my perspective, an enormous gray monster was now taking up space in my tiny apartment. Shedding, shitting, and shredding the furniture. For his part, Paolo understood that it was my fault that he was now stuck in a sealed box in the sky, and he loathed me for this. He expressed his feelings by hissing at me and periodically sinking his teeth and/or claws into my flesh. But over the years, something inexplicable happened. That cat grew on me like a fungus. I started getting a kick out of his relentless sourness. I looked forward to seeing his sullen, scornful face when I got home at night. If he made a mess, I cleaned it up. If he destroyed a garment or a chair or, say, an outrageously expensive and beautiful Turkish rug, I shrugged, sadly. He taught me something I was shocked to learn. A certain kind of very deep love has nothing much to do with compatibility. If you spend enough time taking care of another being, you may eventually find yourself powerless to stem the transformation of your resentment into adoration. Living with cats immunizes you against codependence. And for a guy who talks a lot about being Jewish, you don't seem to have gone to too many shrinks, Mr. Gopnik, because codependence is not a good thing. Biologists have been known to call cats commensal domesticates, which means they choose to live with humans, but they retain the ability to revert back to true feral status, unlike other domesticated species. What you glean from the general feline vibe is essential evolutionary truth. Cats can take us or leave us. As Thorsten Veblen put it, the cat lives with man on terms of equality. By contrast, he said, a dog has the gift of unquestioning subservience and a slave's quickness in guessing his master's moods. I say liberty, equality, fraternity, cats.
We are now at the stage of closing statements. We will first hear from the canine side, Adam Gopnik, and then from the feline, Anthony Lane. Mr. Gopnik.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, members of the cat team. Thank you, my colleagues. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I think this is the easiest decision you will ever have to make in your lives. Again and again, as we listen to the arguments from Team Cat, what did we hear? Yes, it's true that cats are melancholic and isolated, and sometimes in our most melancholic and isolated and depressive moods, we need the company of a cat. My friend Ari has spoken of the relentless sourness of the cat she was presenting to us as Exhibit A in the case for cats. I don't want to appeal to your shallow or your deep-seated political allegiances in any obvious way, but I do ask you, if the young Margaret Thatcher had been given a dog, this is, and this is not a narrow question of Democrats and Republicans, it crosses oceans. And the question of the cat's association with all that is wrong in the world far transcends Margaret Thatcher. So ask yourselves as you cast this terribly important and deciding vote tonight, if you want to stand with this genus, or if you want to cross over and live alongside those who cherish the dog, JFK, who brought a dog with him into the decision room during the Cuban Missile Crisis, knowing that it would bring a note of geniality and perspective to all of his executive committee. Before you cast your vote, look in your heart and ask that. And let me say, the domestication of the dog long preceded the domestication of the cat. And what is it, really, that the dog does? The dog sits right at the edge of the circle between the human and the inhuman. He pries open the circles of compassion and enables us to enter into worlds of objects and animals and creatures that are not human and makes us aware of their intrinsic worth and of their eternal importance. Indeed, the strongest argument I can give you to vote dog tonight is that the power of the dog to lever open those circles of compassion is so great
that it even includes the cat. My friends, that is the reason we ask for your vote tonight for Team Dog. Thank you.
Mr. Lane, for the feline team.
To the dog, life is all, well, how can we say? It's fidelity, it's kindness and a friendship. To the cat, all is mystery and bewilderment. And it presents us with this beautiful vision of the universe as being, well, the universe is like a cat. It is unknowable, lethal, very beautiful, and beyond our comprehension. It shows us, the cat, that even when you think you've solved a puzzle, it remains a puzzle and, in fact, deepens into a mystery. So what is it that dogs actually do? They delay flights. We know that. They fetch game, which is really, really helpful when you've just shot a brace of partridge in Gramercy Park. Did Tom Jones stand up at Las Vegas and say, "What's new, Poochie Wooch?" No, he didn't. Did T.S. Eliot write a poem called McCavity, the Clarity Dog? I know. Did James Bond have a blonde bisexual girlfriend called Doggy Galore? I don't think so. The cat is both wilder and yet somehow more urbane. It is less domesticated, but it is more civilized. We could have gone with that. The other thing we could have told you, finally, is that cat people have better sex. And why is that? Firstly, because we are schooled in sensuality. Secondly, because there is not a flatulent Labrador in the middle of the bed. And thirdly, because we are so refined that afterwards we don't go on about the fact that we did it in the kitty position.
Yeah. Anthony.
Long live the cat. Viva le chat! Lange leben die Katze! Viva le gatto! Mao Wai Tsun! Thank you very much!
We have now come to the decisive part of the evening. First, we will hear in purely applause terms, if we will hear from the dog side and then the cat side. And if I need to hear it again, you'll do it again. So, the dog side, who votes in favor of the dogs? I got the idea. The cat side. Besides Mr. Lane's untoward performance. One more time, dogs. And cats. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, thank you for your extraordinary deliberations. Thank you, both sides. Victory is to the dogs. But joy to all of you. Thank you for coming tonight.
My glorious colleagues Anthony Lane, Adam Gopnik, Malcolm Gladwell, and Ariel Levy from the New Yorker Festival in 2014. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining me today. Hope you have a wonderful new year, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Karen Frohman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino. This week's episode was produced with help from Rhonda Sherman and David Ohana of the New Yorker Festival. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.